I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
And welcome to the Billboard Chart Beat Podcast. Gary Truss, Billboard's Senior Director of Charts. Trevor Anderson, co-host, is coming up through the magic of pre-taping. He's in our interview this week. He's been on vacation, so just cutting this intro myself. But our special guest this week coming up on the podcast, Richard Marx. He was number one this week, 30 years ago, July 23rd, 1988, on the Billboard Hot 100. His very first of three number ones, Hold On to the Night. So we're going to talk to Richard Marx about that, talk about him on social media, what he thinks of social media. He's really outspoken. So we'll get into all that. His new single, it's a version of Dance With My Father that he wrote with Luther Vandross. It was originally a hit in 2003. So that's all coming up as we flash back 30 years, 1988, summer 1988. I just gotten out of junior high school. That's always a good thing to be done with junior high. Moving on to high school. Trevor, I think, was about 3 years from being born in 1988. But great year for music. I was 14, and to this day, still my favorite year of music. They say when you're 14, for a lot of people, that's the music you take with you. Definitely true with me. Even beyond that, I feel like the music of that year was really, really sophisticated, just in a way that some other years really haven't been. Songs like One More Try, George Michael, just trying to picture something like that on top 40 radio nowadays. That Adele kind of came close to that with Someone Like You, some of her more adult-leaning stuff. But a lot of hits like that in 1988, really, really classy pop like that. So just loved the music of 1988. Looking at the top 40 this week, one of my favorite songs of all time, I Know You're Out There Somewhere, Moody Blues, was new in the top 40 at number 38. Bruce Hornsby and the Range was back after their first huge album, The Valley Road, was number 31. Dirty Diana, Michael Jackson, number 30, became the record setting at the time. Fifth number one hit from Bad. Only Katy Perry's Teenage Dream has since tied that record. Tracy Chapman, Fast Car, number 27. The Twist, the Fat Boys, their remake of The Twist was up to number 22, the original by Chubby Checker, the all-time number one hit in the Billboard Hot 100's history. Chicago was back with I Don't Want to Live Without Your Love. Elton John, one of his biggest hits in a long time in 1988, I Don't Want to Go On With You Like That. DJ Jazzy Jeff and The Fresh Prince, Parents Just Don't Understand, at number 12. Looking to the top 10. Let's play the top 10 this week. 1988, July 23rd, on our way to number one. And our special guest this week on the podcast, Richard Marx, on the Billboard Chart Beat Podcast.
Number 10. Number 9.
When
Number 7. Number 6. Number 5. Number 1.
Richard Marks, thank you so much for coming on the Billboard Sharpie podcast.
It's always a pleasure.
All right, so we're flashing back, 30 years. July 23rd, 1988, Hold On to the Nights went to number one on the Hot 100. Do you remember actually finding out the song had gone to number one on the Hot 100? Or you're a big chart fan over the years?
Yeah, of course. You know, everybody wants that experience. I've been lucky to have it several times, and that was the first one. I remember the first single, Don't Mean Nothing, peaked at number three in the pop chart, and then the follow-up, Should Have Known Better, also peaked at number three, and then we inched a little closer with Endless Summer Nights. But I remember the week that Endless Summer Nights went to number two, Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror went to number one, and I thought, well, there's that. But then when Hold On to the Nights went to number one, I distinctly remember for a really awesome reason, which is that I was on a very long tour. I'd started touring almost a year before, playing in clubs, and then I was lucky enough to get to open for REO Speedwagon on their summer tour in 1987. So then, you know, a whole year later, I was headlining the same outdoor venues and sheds that I had played with REO the year before as an opener. And it's just this tour that just never stopped, you know, it just went on for 15 months straight. And so the night that I got the call from the label saying that Hold On to the Nights was going to be the number one single, I not only got to go out to the audience, and I think I was in Cleveland at Blossom, which is a, you know, big outdoor venue, if it's even still called that, you know, now that all these great outdoor venues all have these corporate names now, but it was right. A place called Blossom in Cleveland. And I got to tell, you know, all 8,000 people that the song I was just about to play was the new number one song in the country. And so that was incredible. But the best part of it for me was I just happened to have my grandfather with me, hanging out with me on tour. I'd flown him out for a couple of shows. He was in his 80s, but he was still really, really healthy and youthful. And just, he and I were really close when I was growing up. He was a remarkable man. His name was Dwayne. And so he got to celebrate my first number one single with me. You know, he was at that show. We went out to dinner afterwards. We, you know, we had a beer, and it was amazing. You know, I mean, as an artist, as a songwriter, I don't care what anybody says. You know, we all want to be number one, and that was certainly always something that was on my bucket list, was to have a number one album, have a number one single, among other things. So it was great to experience that, and especially the first time.
Is the song, I read it was based on a true story, but not about you, right? It was someone else that had this storyline in their life?
Yeah, I mean, I've been writing songs for years, and I was young. I was only 23 when I wrote Hold On to the Night, and so there was only so much of my own personal life I could draw from. You know, I had certainly had the experience of, I wasn't married yet, but I was in a long relationship with my first wife. And so I'd already, as a young guy, I'd experienced at least the feeling of being young and being in a relationship and being in love with someone, but also, you know, meeting people and thinking, you know, what if, you know, what if I was single, or, wow, you know, am I too young to be in such a serious relationship? Or, so there was a little bit of that, that I could, you know, there was a little bit of that, yearning, if you will, that I could kind of infuse into the lyric. But it was really about a friend of mine that was going through, he was older than me, he was married, he was caught up in a triangle, and he was tortured by it. And so I just, you know, I without ever betraying his confidence, because I never, you know, said who it was, I remember saying, dude, I need to, you know, come up with some different material here, and I'm going to write about your situation. And he's like, okay, as long as there's no names involved, I'm cool with that.
Have people come up to you over the years, and maybe just seeing the title, they just think it's a straight up love song? Have you heard from people who think there are people who said it was their wedding song, not realizing maybe what all the lyrics are about?
I don't think wedding song. I've had people, use certain songs that have always been a little puzzling to me. You know, people have used Right Here Waiting for their wedding song, like a song about two people that, you know, want to be together but aren't together. It's almost like, you know, I'm sure that you've heard the story with Sting, that people have told him that Every Breath You Take, you know, was sung at their wedding. And he said, I look at these people and go, well, good luck with that.
Right.
You know, it's a song about stalking. Yeah. And when now people come up to me and I go, hey, we used your song at our wedding, I always go, should have known better. No, I'm just kidding. but no, not for weddings, but I'll tell you what Hold On to the Nights has become is a prom anthem. And even though it's not lyrically on the nose, the sort of overall hold on to the memories, hold on to this moment, certainly did lend itself to something like a prom. And so it's become to this day a huge prom theme, a big enough prom theme that Family Guy lampooned it, you know, used it in an episode where Meg was at a prom, and that was like she loved the song. So.
Yeah, I think Brian was rolling his eyes as it played.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So when you wrote the song, did you know that this would be a hit? Did you have any indication, any feeling that this could be your first number one?
No, I've never written a song that I thought was a hit at the time that I wrote it. I've never had that experience that I've heard other songwriters talk about where they just, you know, they go, I just knew. And I don't know, maybe if I ever had that feeling, I would have stifled it, because I just feel like it's... you know, bad karma maybe, or and it's just never been, as much as I've always, you know, wanted to have songs be successful, that wasn't the motive. That wasn't the motivation to write whatever it was I was writing. I was writing just because I needed to say whatever it was I wanted to say. And I was just creating. I was just, you know, making things. And in my case, I make songs. I make up songs. And I've never gotten hung up on whether something is commercial or, you know, I've always left that to other people. I've left it to the, you know, if I was at a record company, I would leave it up to the record company. If my manager or if radio promoters and people would weigh in on what songs they thought were the most, had the most potential commercially, I'd go, okay, whatever. I don't have any, you know, here's 10 songs that I wrote that I love all of them. You know, whichever ones you want to be the singles, I don't care. So no, it was never a feeling like I thought, oh, I'm onto something here. I'm onto my first number one single. In fact, when I wrote the song, when I wrote Hold On to the Night, I wrote it in 1986, and it came out in 87 on the album, and then it was a hit in 88. And in 86, I was just completely obsessed with Peter Gabriel's So album. I'm still kind of obsessed with that album. And the production, Peter's production, especially on the slower songs like Mercy Street and Don't Give Up, they were very sparse and very ethereal. And even though I knew that Hold On to the Nights could easily be produced as a power ballad, as a straight ahead arena rock ballad, like there were plenty of those going on around at the time, as a producer, I went in, and as an arranger, I went in and I wanted to try to borrow from the influence of the Peter Gabriel stuff that I was so crazy about. And that's why, you know, there's no drums until the last 35 seconds of the song. And it's very ethereal, and there's a lot of space, and it didn't sound like anything else on the radio. And so much so that I remember, not only the A&R department of my label EMI at the time, but certainly the head of radio promotion, they were telling me that it just wouldn't work. You know, I remember the head of radio promotion, pop radio, saying, dude, nothing happens until the end. And they begged me to go back in and re-record it and recut it and have the drums come in the first chorus and just, it's like, please sound like everything else.
Yeah.
And I just was like, nah, this is the vision I have for this. And if it's a hit, great. And if it's not, it's exactly what I wanted it to sound like. And, you know, even now when I occasionally will hear it on the radio, I listen to that one a lot because I love the record that I made of this song. You know, Patrick O'Hearn from Missing Persons played fretless bass on it. An incredible session guitarist named Michael Landau, who's played on a million huge records, played all the guitars. I love the entrance of the drums, very much, you know, borrowing from Phil Collins in The Air Tonight, where kind of out of nowhere is this huge drum fill that, you know, takes us into a whole nother place. And that the drums were played by Tristan Bowden, who was in Kenny Loggins' band forever. And then, has been a member of the group Chicago for years, and you know, some incredible players surrounding me playing piano and singing. So yeah, I'm really proud of the record. I think there's parts of it that actually still sound pretty fresh. I mean, some of it sounds a little dated to me, but some of it kind of holds up for me. Don't you open your heart, 'cause it don't mean nothing, the words that
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, I love how it always kind of comes back to that. The secret of success for a lot of songs seems to be that they sound pretty much like what is out at the time, but there's something just a little bit different that separates it enough. And that's what makes it stand out enough and usually winds up being a number one hit.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of, it's kind of how I started at radio. You know, Don't Mean Nothing came out in the spring of 1987 when pretty much everything you heard on pop radio anyway were either, was either a hair band, you know, a hair metal band track or disco, you know, like 80s disco dance music. And to have a real organic sort of Southern California rock and roll mid-tempo song with three of the Eagles performing on it. And we hadn't, you know, there hadn't been an Eagles record in 7 years at that point.
Right.
It was so, I remember thinking there's no way radio or pop radio is going to play this. Maybe rock radio will play it. And rock radio, you know, it was a number one rock track, but I didn't think it would cross to pop radio because it didn't sound like anything else that anybody was playing. And to your point, of course, that's one of the reasons I think it did become a hit was because it didn't sound like anything else.
All right. The other thing I wanted to ask you while we have you here today, Richard, is you on social media. I've been a fan of your music, obviously, for so long now, but I'm such a fan of Richard Marks, the person on Twitter, because I know I'm always going to get something honest from you, whether it's something as a lot of it is just thanking fans who said they loved your show. Maybe they saw you for the first time. They've been waiting to see you for years. You're just thanking them. But you get into obviously a lot of social issues, and you're very honest. Either way, you've said, you recently tweeted, you voted both Democrat and Republican over the years. You've been really critical of the current administration. But it always seems like you're just going back to truth and decency is what you want to see come out of government.
You know, I got to tell you, man, that the social media thing, particularly the Twitter situation, you know, I find that I don't really enjoy the interaction so much because I have never seen so much rampant ignorance and lack of education, lack of awareness of facts. I am starting to little by little, I'm starting to think maybe I'd rather be uninformed than misinformed.
Yeah.
And so there's so much viciousness, on that particular platform that, you know, whereas Instagram, I generally enjoy that more because it's just a little bit more, about, you know, just to capturing a photographic moment. You know, for a while I was even using Instagram to be a little bit more socially or politically vocal. And again, it just brings out the worst in people. I personally don't understand. I can't fathom the idea of seeing, coming across a post of someone who I have never met, who I probably will never meet, and they posted something that they felt, you know, they posted their opinion about something maybe that's going on. The idea that I would comment to them, especially something nasty, because I maybe disagreed with what they said, is like anathema to me. Like, I don't understand it even from a mental health standpoint. It was just something that would never, ever occur to me because I have a life. You know, I don't care what you post on your Twitter page. It's your Twitter page. Post what you want. Unless you're targeting me, unless you say something nasty about me or somebody that I love, or, you know, I mean, there's no reason for me to weigh in on what you said negatively. But that's really what these platforms have become. It's just an arena for people to say the most vile, disgusting things that they would never have the guts to say to that person's face. And I think it's, you know, you have to ask me week to week. You know, sometimes I'll go, no, you know what? It's really good. It's good interaction. It's good. And there are things about it I love in terms of being able to thank the fans, right, and people, yeah, that have been loyal to me. And I do try to do as much of that as I do bashing the trolls. And I also love it to shine a light on other people's work that I really love. I love talking about, you know, somebody's new song that I heard that I really love and just turning people onto it, or even just reminding people of songs that maybe you haven't heard for a while. You know, like quite a while, I mean, it was like a year ago or 9 months ago, I tweeted something about Bobby Caldwell's What You Won't Do for Love, which is, to me, one of the greatest records ever made. It's just incredible, and it sounds just as fresh today as it ever did. And I don't know Bobby Caldwell, but I gave it a shout out, and people just were like, "Oh my God, yeah, that song! I'm going to go download it." I completely forgot that one. You know, I love that. I love that kind of. I love the power of social media platforms for that. And look, let's face it. I have Twitter to thank for meeting my wife, Daisy Fuentes. You know, if we hadn't been following the same person, Martha Quinn, on Twitter, we might not have met. Believe me, I've got nothing but love for it in a certain way. But if you were to ask me this week, I think it's, for me, it's a case of diminished returns. And I find myself feeling better, just in my psyche when I step away from it for a while. You know, I definitely need to go on breaks from all social media. Just sometimes it just gets too much for me.
So in particular, you know, a lot of artists in the past couple of years have gotten a lot of flack for either, you know, staying completely out of politics and any sort of political topic, or some artists, of course, have gotten a lot of flack for jumping in at every point. Do you have any thoughts on what you think an artist's role with social media should be, you know, in an ideal world? Should they use this platform to engage and talk, or should they just, you know, some people say just stick to the music, stick to your promotion, and stick to safety?
Oh, no, it's completely subjective. You know, it's the same thing that, you know, I remember for years, people would ask me, do you feel like artists have a responsibility to give back to community, to the world, in terms of charities and raising awareness for things? And then the answer is no. I don't think that you have a responsibility as an artist. I feel like I have a responsibility as a human to help in ways that I can help. And it just happens that some of the ways that I can help, either bring awareness or raise funds or help, you know, charities, is through being an artist. It just happens that, you know, we, the people, you know, we're in the public eye. We have fan bases, so we can bring attention to plights, to causes, to, you know, great charities. But it's not a responsibility. I'm a little allergic to that word, because I really do think it's subjective. I feel the same way about people in the entertainment business, or any walk of life, weighing in on their social media platforms about politics. It's completely subjective. I don't think you have any kind of responsibility to do it or call to do it. I actually kind of envy, there are a couple of people that I'm really good friends with who will not go there on their social media platform. It's just their music. It's just promoting their shows, promoting their music. And I envy that. You know, it's just, that's not how I'm wired. I respect that they don't want to do that. But for me, it's been an avenue for me to sort of just, it started out really just being a smart ass. You know, I have a pretty sarcastic sense of humor. And before I got political on Twitter, I just would use it to sort of venture into a different art form, which was, can I be really funny in this limited number of characters, you know, which was harder before when we had less time to tweet, less room to tweet. But then little by little, you know, as you get older, I think you get more, I'd like to think that just getting older is what makes you more engaged in what's going on in the world and injustices. And, but at the end of the day, a very long-winded answer, I really don't think anybody gives a shit. I really don't. I wouldn't expect anyone to care what my personal political opinion is about any one issue. It just happens to be the way I feel about it. But people get incensed and outraged and freaked out. And at the end of the day, I don't think it does anybody any good. So I don't see a lot of, I think the one thing that is great about Twitter is when you can disseminate injustices and you can bring attention to causes and situations that need to be addressed. Beyond that, I don't know that it's anything but sort of a, you know, one big round of masturbation.
Yeah, to talk about sarcasm, I don't know if you saw this comment. I just chuckled when I saw this. Recently, you tweeted something. I don't know exactly what it was. It was pretty serious. Maybe it was a series of tweets. It was, you know, pretty deep. It was fairly philosophical. And someone responded, "Well, I'm glad I didn't dance to that at my prom." So it just kind of pointed out how there's Richard Marx.
I love that.
Richard Marx, the artist. Richard Marx on Twitter being more social. That's what an artist is in 2018.
I love that. I do think, you know, one thing that I think is important, one distinction that I think is important to be made is that this, and look, people just become robots and they just repeat what somebody else said. And one of the things that is the catchphrase now is, you know, stick to music, or stick to acting.
Right.
As if I don't pay taxes, as if I'm not allowed, because I'm a singer, I don't get to weigh in on something that I might be way more informed about than you are, even though you're a plumber. And I would, the idea of saying to a, you know, an electrician, you know, stick to the electricity. You don't get to have a political opinion.
Right.
That's just ridiculous. It's just this very tiny minded, ignorant, philosophy, for, you know, for lack of a better word, because it's really not a philosophy. It's just ignorance, and I think it's more rampant now than ever before. I think we're at a time, maybe in the world, but certainly in this country, where we've never been more discourteous, more unkind, and more lost than we are right now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I haven't been around very long, but. It's just amazing when people get behind the keyboard, the courage that they somehow find. And especially, you know, when people, you know, you think, you know, somebody and what they, who they are, and, you know, they're really hiding this whole secret identity. I mean, it's
bullying made easy.
Really, yeah. And I mean, especially 'cause everybody now has a platform and a voice and, you know, can just turn so nasty and say the meanest things and bully and gang up on people. And not only that, then that, you know, they find your address and post it out there and find, you know, hack your email.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just incredible. The lengths that people will go to try and destroy somebody for, you know, just a simple difference in beliefs.
Yeah. I mean, and there are people who post their political views, and in some cases, you know, it's vile shit that they post, who are in the public eye, who may be actors, for example. And I also think it's interesting because, the fear, and I think this circles back to some of my artist friends who won't go down that road because they're afraid of alienating any fan. And again, I think that's wise. You know, I think I envy it to a degree. I just don't care. And the idea that someone would somebody who might really love what I do musically and artistically, who would no longer like what I do because they disagree with something that I said politically, just shows what an intellectual midget they are. And, you know, there are people, like I said, that I know that if I sat down to dinner with them, I probably would not, it wouldn't go well. But it doesn't mean that I don't really appreciate their artistry or their talent. Because I, you know, 'cause I'm intellectually capable of being cool with all of the above.
We can't even get her into our room for another 3 hours because it was flooded with sewage.
Yes, but we have these free drink vouchers.
But they're not valid unless we purchase a third entree.
Yes, but we're together.
And you're in love. I mean, I think you're in love. I can only hear every sixth word you're saying.
Every night only, Buddy Daiquiri.
Yeah, it's a stage name. I thought it sounded more like a lounge musician. My real name's Joey Midnight.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, here's one you might like.
Just to take a hold on to the night, so as we wrap things up, Richard, into 2018, I was just watching a clip of you, I guess, whistling Hold On to the Nights as a lounge singer named Buddy Daiquiri on Life in Pieces. Are you starting to do more fun TV kind of bits like that? I'm not sure I remember seeing you do things like that before.
No, I mean, I think it's just that, you know, they've asked me. And And if I'm not booked, if I'm not on the road, or if it's not, you know, I'm on vacation with Daisy, I go, yeah, sure, why not? You know, I mean, the Bachelorette thing, I hesitated for a minute because I've never seen any of those reality shows. But I know that it's huge and I know that people love it. And the way they presented it to me, you know, it was a matter of, you know, spending 2 hours one afternoon. And it was fine. You know, it was fun. They were nice people. And I just, I certainly don't mind appearing on things like that for mainly two reasons. One, to have people go, oh my God, look, it's Richard Marx. Yeah. Or people go, who is that? And then they figure it out. And then they go find out. You know, because there were plenty of people, I'm sure, on The Bachelorette who had no idea who I was. And my manager, actually, the week after that show aired, my manager called me and he said, we just got it. They get some, you know, we all get data reports, like, incessantly, as you guys know.
Yeah.
And apparently my Wikipedia search page just blew up, you know, like, just tremendous amount of hits on my Wikipedia page, which means, you know, mission accomplished. People went, I want to know who he is, you know, the people that didn't know. So that's worthwhile. And there was, you know, it's not like I'm doing anything that I wouldn't, you know, that I'm against. It's not like I'm compromising anything. The Life in Pieces thing was so great because they wrote me into the script. They initially just wanted to use a couple of my songs, but then they kind of got a sense that I don't take myself seriously at all. And so the character that they wrote for me was hilarious. You know, Tommy Sadowski, who I was in the scene with, and I've become friendly through it. And it was a blast. It was really, really a fun day.
I know I'm praying for much too much, but could you send back the only man she loved? I know you don't do it usually, but dear Lord, she's dying to dance with my father again.
Also want to bring up a really recent release. You just put out on YouTube about a couple weeks ago, a cover of the song you wrote with Luther Vandross, Dance With My Father, which won Song of the Year at the Grammy Awards about 15 years ago. So what made you at this stage, I know you performed it a couple times live, but what made you put out your own recording for the first time? And what was writing that song like for you?
Well, writing it was very much like the several other songs I wrote with Luther back in the day. We became really great friends. He came and sang background vocals on several tracks on different albums I made. But more importantly, we were just really, really close friends. He was one of my best friends. And we started writing together a couple of years after becoming friends. And we wrote the single from his Christmas album, a song called Every Year, Every Christmas. We wrote another song for another album. And then he had this idea for Dance With My Father. And I know that one of the reasons that he came to me to write it with him, separate from everything else, is that I had lost my father about 7 years before we wrote that song, very tragically and suddenly. And Luther was one of the only people in my life who helped, really, truly helped me get through it, you know, especially at the peak of the grief. You know, he was always there for me. And there were many times when I would call him, or he would call me to check on me, and we would have these really long conversations. And he was an incredible friend to me, especially during that brutal time for me. And he learned really about my father through my stories and through me grieving the loss of my father. So I think that was a big reason that when he came up with his idea for the song about his father, that he came to me to co-write it with him. So that the lyric is really Luther's story. It's completely about Luther's experiences and his memories of his father. And I really just helped drive it musically. And so we finished it, and then he went in and recorded it soon thereafter. And I think it was maybe a week or 10 days after he recorded it that he had the stroke that ultimately, you know, took him from us. So the success of that song, the power of that song, is very bittersweet for me. I'm thrilled. You know, I get people come up to me, talk to me about that song all the time. I play it in concert. I see people very emotional when I sing it. And so I'm proud as can be to be a part of it. It's also hard for me because I really miss my friend, you know, but I also make a point to always sing it in my show and talk about him because I don't want anybody to forget about him. He was a remarkable man and a remarkable artist. And, so, you know, I have a deep emotional attachment to that co-write. It never occurred to me to record it myself, but I've been singing it in concert now for a couple of years with just me and just at the piano, just me and the piano. And so I realized that I had recorded, covers of several of the other songs I've written for and with other people. You know, the NSYNC song, that's I Promise You, I have a recording of that. To Where You Are that I wrote for Josh Groban, I recorded that. Different songs, but I'd never cut Dance With My Father. And so I really just did it as an experiment. And I liked it. And so I thought, you know, it's just a good thing to have in my catalog. You know, Luther obviously has the definitive version. But nobody's recorded that song in a long time. So I thought, you know, why not me? So at least it's out there and there's another very intimate version of it.
And such a great song. In particular, I think, you know, there are a lot of songs, and rightfully so, that celebrate mothers. I feel like there's not really a whole lot of songs out there that really pay tribute to fathers. And so I think, you know, even on Father's Day or especially this kind of song, you know, when somebody loses their father, you know, this is great because there's a song out there that's for that particular, you know, traumatic emotional experience. And I think, I mean, obviously, I love the song. I'm lucky enough that my father, of course, is still here. But every time I hear it, you know, somebody posting it on Facebook or somebody on Twitter talking about it, it must be really rewarding as a songwriter in particular to know that you've made such an impact on so many people who all can relate to this one thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. With every song that has had an impact on people emotionally, those songs were never written with that as the objective. It was never like I or Luther and I sat down and said, we're going to write a song that really resonates with it. No, it's all very selfish. It's all very just communicating a feeling. It's all just sort of putting it out there to help myself. You know, I've written several songs since my father died that really deal with my own personal story and missing him. And but whether it's Dance With My Father or, you know, I can't count, I've lost count of the number of soldiers, male and female, who have stopped me somewhere and told me that Right Here Waiting, to this day, they still use Right Here Waiting as their song when they're away from their significant other. And that song is their song. Even though I wrote it for very, very selfish reasons and specific reasons that had nothing to do with that. Hold On to the Nights being, you know, people coming up to me going, every time I hear Hold On to the Nights, I think of my prom and I get, you know, really nostalgic or whatever it is. You know, there are songs that people have written throughout my life that it's as if they wrote it about me. And that's what I do as well. You know, I'm writing songs that I'm writing for myself, but we're all so connected in so many different ways. And we're all the same in so many ways. We experience so much of the same stuff that when someone sort of really says it, when they really say it the way you'd like to say it but can't, that's powerful. And even I as a songwriter have experienced other songwriters saying something better than I could have. That, you know, instead of me being able to write the song that helps me through a situation in my life, sometimes it's another songwriter that says it better than I did, you know?
And of course, it was the best song of the year, according to the Grammys that year. And I know, you know, accolades and awards can mean only so much sometimes to some people, but I feel like Song of the Year is a category, particularly as a songwriter, that you must really treasure because I know Stevie Wonder, you know, has won 3 Album of the Year Grammys. And on a special last year, he said he still wants to win Song of the Year. He still wants to have that. So that moment, what was that moment like, you know, as a songwriter? That must have been just the ultimate accolade that you could get, that, you know, you wrote the best tune of the year.
Well, I don't look at it that way because it's so subjective. And there were other songs that year, even songs that were nominated, that I thought were phenomenal songs. I'm not comfortable sort of agreeing with the premise that it was the best song of the year. I will say though that having it be acknowledged, by the organization that represents the art form that I am in, which is music, and having the Grammy voters say we're going to acknowledge this as the song of the year, whatever that means. As a songwriter, yes, the answer is it doesn't get better than that. If you write songs for a living and you write songs because that's just what you are. And I started writing songs when I was 15. So, I mean, I don't remember not writing songs. There is no better pat on the back than the Grammy Song of the Year. It was surreal for me. It was absolutely surreal. I was kind of surprised that we won, and thrilled. And also, again, you know, bittersweet because Luther was, he was still alive, but he couldn't be there with me at the awards. He was in the hospital, and he was in really rough shape. And it was just a few months after that he passed. And I did get to go see him. You know, I went to see him, I think, a few days after we won, and I went to the hospital to hang out with him. And I just think many times I've thought, what an incredible night that would have been if he'd been there. You know, we probably would have gotten arrested. You know, we probably would have made the papers the next day for all the wrong reasons. You know, we would have just torn some shit up.
All right, Richard, thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure to chat. We've chatted before. It's always great to hear you talking about so many different topics, just being honest about everything, whether it's something serious or more just joking, sarcastic. It's always great to get your take on all these things. And somehow it's been 30 years since Hold On to the Nights was number one. So congratulations on the anniversary.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Thank you. Right. Thank you. Always a pleasure.
All right. Thanks so much, Richard.
Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it.
Take care.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.